It's Sunday, October 9th, and you're listening to the Student-Centered Learning Podcast. I'm your host, Arthur Baraff, and I am here with Sean McClung. He is the principal of the Impact Academy in Hayward, California. It's part of Envision Schools, which is a charter network in the Bay Area, and it's one of the best schools in the Bay Area for serving low-income students of color. Welcome, Sean, to the podcast.
Thanks, Arthur. Great to be here with you.
So I've known Sean for a while. He's one of the smartest guys I know, so I was excited to invite him on and hear him talk about his school and let educators who are listening know about this network of schools, some of their student-centered practices, and point you in a direction to find more. So Sean, why don't you start us off by just telling us about your school? What's it like? What would you see if you walked in? How is it different from the traditional school around the corner?
I say one of the first things that people notice when they come to visit the school are the relationships that the students have with one another and with the staff and faculty. And that's something that we work really hard on in terms of building community and advisory and of connecting with families and students. So I think that there's a lot of different ways, obviously, that you'd see that coming into the school. But there's a sense that students feel a sense of ownership over the school and over the space. And that's one of the first things that you would see. You would see a bunch of portraits that students make when they graduate. They all take digital media arts courses, and so the hallways are lined with the portraits of our graduates, and they include information like what they want to study and the colleges that they're going to, and that's a reminder to all of our students about where they're headed. So there's definitely a strong college-going focus in terms of making sure all students have access to schools when they graduate. So those would be some of the first things that you would see walking around our school.
And now zooming up about 1,000 feet, what are some of the networks that your school is connected to, and how does it sort of map to the broader school reform movements in the United States?
That's a big question. Let me zoom up. Hold on here. I think that that's a good question. I'm not sure how to answer that in terms of what other groups that we're connected with. As an individual school site, we partner with a number of different organizations. Let me start there and see if that's answering your question.
Sure.
One of the challenges that we've had is we're able to manage to get a really high percentage of our young people accepted into four-year colleges, which is really a feat, especially for students, a majority of whom are first in their families to be going to college. Once they get accepted, of course, the challenge then is how are they able to afford to go to the college and stay in the college until they've earned a diploma. Or earned a degree. And so we've partnered with a group called USPIRE in the last couple of years that's really worked on college affordability counseling. And so that's been a really fruitful partnership to make sure that our families and students have access to some good financial aid counseling so that they can make good decisions about where to go after they graduate from our high school. I've worked with other groups more locally in the Bay Area. One of them is a national group called the Network for Teaching Entrepreneurship to really work with some of our incoming ninth graders around helping them, I would say, one, build math skills at the same time as they're building a sense of competence in themselves and the ability to work in teams and do problem solving. And so that's been a newer partnership that we've used to really make the learning they're doing authentic and really try not to make one of our, what ends up being a math intervention, because our students come in many years behind in math, not to be a deficits model of a course that tries to kind of fill in the gaps, but also at the same time helps them to see themselves as competent and capable learners and see math in some different contexts. So that's another group that we work with. Let's see, is that starting to answer your question?
Yeah, and I wanted to give you a chance to talk about how Impact Academy is a part of your network called Vision and connections to the deeper learning sort of coalition of schools that are doing.
Right. Yeah, I think, yeah, so we definitely are part of a larger coalition of schools that include places like High Tech High and the Big Picture Learning Network around deeper learning. That's been, I think, put together a lot by the Hewlett Foundation. And so one of the things that our whole network focuses on are these defenses of learning that happen at the end of the 10th and the 12th grades, where students individually stand up in front of a panel, much like a thesis defense, and explain not only a couple different artifacts they've completed in terms of their work, and answer questions in real time about the work that they've done, but also the process of learning and how they've changed and developed as people, and what are the important experiences they've had and how they're planning to move forward either in the upper division of our school or after graduation and their life as a college student. And so these defenses are a really significant rite of passage for our students and a really important signal to them that they're actually capable and able to do something that is really high stakes as a student, and that it really speaks to a lot of their, I say their resilience and their, in a sense of building a lot of resilience for them. And so that is something that all three of our schools or network participate in. And we have a group called Envision Learning Partners that does, they go to different schools across the country in the US and they work with schools that want to build in these authentic performance assessment programs to help students do similar work in their schools. So that's a part of our organization that that brings that learning to other districts all around the country.
So I want to understand these practices a little more. You know, the students could have just taken a big final exam that could have been high stakes and made them feel resilient and strong after accomplishing that. I mean, what's the difference between some sort of final exam paper and pencil demonstration of understanding versus these portfolio defenses? Why do you think that they work better?
Yeah, well, I think that they're part of a system. And so we definitely do have some final exams. We want students prepared for those, but they're not, that can't be the end all, right? And so what makes these performance assessments different is one is the collaboration. So all the students are doing it together at the same time. And what happens is this really beautiful moment of time, which is actually much of April and May, when students are putting together these portfolios, working with one another and getting input from each other. So the 10th graders are doing this and they're all in the same situation where they all have to get through and do this thing. And they have 9th grade buddies and their advisories that help give them some feedback and are learning from watching them how that process is going to be for them. And there's a situation where everyone is just all hands on deck and supporting each other to get through. A lot of times students will not actually successfully defend and they will have to represent. And that can be a really serious moment to feel a sense of kind of failure, but also a sense of being able to revise and do something again until you have it good enough. So that's an important moment for students too, when they are not able to pass, that they rally support and they have their friends and their advisor to help them really figure out what they need to do differently, put that work together and see the process through. And so that process of revision and not just either giving students an A, B, C or a D or an F and kind of letting them move on through, but saying, no, there's a bar that we have for all of our students and they either pass or they don't. And if they don't, they have to revise. That all those things fit together to make a really important process that students look back on and feel really grateful for, especially when they come back from college and say how well that prepared them for the kind of work and the kind of thinking that they would be doing in college.
So they're putting these portfolios together. I'm assuming that they have sort of a list of requirements for the portfolio. What kinds of things go in it? And then how do you assess the quality of the work that's in it? Are there rubrics? Are these performance tasks that demonstrate skills? Just tell me a little bit more about how it works.
Yeah, there are definitely performance tasks that they do in their courses. And so a student might have, one example might be something they would do like in a pre-calculus or a calculus class about sine or cosine waves related to a simulation. I think one of them they do is around this idea that you would need to, if you're going to, it's actually a funny one, it's called ectastic. They have to figure out where on the earth they would want to put some of these operations for eggs, and they'll figure out the length of the day at the different latitudes of where they're putting this farm, and then figure out where else they're all some different conditions about where to put it, and they have to be able to understand how they're graphing sine and cosine waves. So all these things go together into the simulation that they put together, and the work that they do on that project then gets graded by that teacher, who determines on a rubric about whether or not they've actually fulfilled all the requirements for this particular task. Once that is deemed proficient based on the course that they had it in, that can go into their portfolio. And then if they choose to use that as part of their defense, they would have to be ready to stand up and explain to everyone else how that work connects to the world, what were the struggles they had when they were learning it, what are the things that they learned through the process of doing that, and how it fits into the overall course that they were taking. And then that becomes one of the artifacts that they quote unquote defend during that defense. And so that's how each of these pieces as a performance task from a particular course gets into that portfolio and then gets defended if it's one of those couple. They do three, they'll defend three pieces as 10th graders and three pieces as 12th graders. They just have more pieces that are required in the overall portfolio depending on the grade level.
So would it be fair to say that the courses themselves have these performance tasks as assessments that are assessed for the students to show proficiency, but when they choose those pieces for their defense, you're really asking them to do more metacognitive work about the process and about the meaningfulness of that work to their own lives. And what you're really assessing in those defenses are more those connections and ownership over the learning that happened?
That's right, absolutely. And the other interesting piece that you asked about the assessment part is that, as you understand, the piece itself is either deemed proficient and ready to be defended or not by the teacher who teaches that content area. The performance task of actually defending it and doing all the metacognitive moves that you just described, that piece and their actual performance, their actual defense and ability to answer questions in the moment, and their poise and all the rest that goes into doing a defense, that gets graded by a panel of advisors, some of whom may not teach that subject. And so what this does for the school is it requires that all the teachers understand to a certain degree what is the content that they're expecting students to understand and learn from all of their courses. And so the teachers have to really educate themselves on what's going on across the curriculum in that grade level, which really helps there to be a lot more collective responsibility around what is our level of expectation for our students' ability to understand and be able to explain their thinking and learning. And so that adds a whole other level to the discourse of the teachers at the school, if that makes sense.
It does, and I was also curious about the teachers and how they norm or come to agreement about these performance tasks or about these defense evaluations. Is that something that is worked on in small teams as a whole faculty?
Yeah, we do video norming sessions initially so that we watch together as a staff students defending, and then we go through the rubric and debate and argue about whether or not we felt it met a certain criteria on our rubric. And that's an important step. And then we also have live students come do live defenses in front of the staff at faculty meetings in order to norm with them and have a chance to really see how we're responding so that we have as consistent as possible a response to what goes on in the actual defenses. And so it is a lot of work that we do around that. And that, again, builds a sense of understanding and buy-in among the staff about how it is that we're holding the expectations for students. And there's always two of the advisors on each of the panels. And there's also students on the panels as well. So the students are there to really be able to provide input. And to also, the students who are on the panels are usually the grade that is about to do that the following year. And so they have a chance to actually witness and see and hear how the adults are thinking about whether the students are meeting our expectations and hear the feedback that students get. So there's always this cycling of students knowing what's coming next so that we build that into their experience throughout the 4 years of the school.
You mentioned that students have come back and told you that these defenses were important to them in terms of preparing them for college. What feedback do you get from parents and guardians about these defenses? Are they even there to see them? Are they invited? And if so, what do you hear?
We're pretty blessed in having a community that comes out for a lot of events for high school students, and that really, I think, surprises some folks who have the assumption that high school families just don't show up in the way the elementary school families do. And so they come out for exhibitions, they come out for college nights, they come out for a whole lot of events. The defenses are interesting because they're so high stakes. A lot of students are they're less likely to have their families come out. And so we and the faculty often encourage families to come and be there because they're a really meaningful moment. But they're not always there for them, and partly because the students are so anxious about them. So there is a lot of anxiety around the defenses. But I can tell you that as a rite of passage, they're very significant. And a lot of times they're, especially the senior ones, because these are in the last months of their high school career before students are going to leave home, many of them, and go off to college, which again is a really big moment for a student who's first in their family to attend college. There's a lot of tears and there's a lot of emotion at the conclusion of the defenses, whether or not they pass or whether or not they have to represent. So to answer your question directly, families families carry a lot of that stress and anxiety that their students have. And so they feel very similar to the students, actually, that it's a huge and really demanding process. And they're all very grateful when it's over and very proud that they've made it through that process because it's very meaningful. But they recognize just how demanding and challenging it is. But they appreciate, the same way our students do, that they're much stronger, more resilient, more resourced when they are able to see this process through than if they hadn't. And so it is, in the end, if you ask students and parents, a really valuable experience. And they'll be honest with you about how challenging it is.
I wanted to switch gears to one of the other practices I know that is student-centered that Impact Academy has had success with, and that is your internship program. I work at a school where the internship program is really robust, but it's often sort of beyond the reach of a lot of other school districts because of various contextual factors. So I always like to hear about how schools are doing it on a more compact scale, which is, you know, maybe more manageable for a school that's not doing anything yet to think about. So tell us about it.
Right. And I as you know, my experience having been an advisor in a big picture school and a principal of a big picture high school, have experience with a much more involved internship program. And so it has been really interesting for me to see how Impact Academy manages to make sure that students do have an experience with real world experience internships, and at the same time not putting as much emphasis or resource into it as some other schools have. And so the details first are that we do it with our 11th and 12th graders, and we do it for only about 10 weeks. And so 11th and 12th graders all will, for one day a week for about 10 weeks, go off to an internship. And all of the upper division or 11th and 12th grade advisors are responsible for their group of advisees in terms of finding an internship, checking in with students about when they're there, and being in connection with their mentors and the work sites. And so in some of those ways, it's very similar to a big picture internship. One of the things that was, I guess, surprising to me was that for a school, and our school is much, it's not as nearly kind of radically redesigned as a big picture school is, right? We still have students move through a series of different content area subject courses, and it's much more similar to the modal high school than a big picture school would be. And so I was really interested in how you would make a school that's structured so similarly work with an internship program. And it actually, in some ways, it surprised me at how feasible it is if you just set aside the time. So I think because we have advisory, we start earlier in the year. Students are building resumes, exploring interests, and get some coaching on how to make phone calls and cold calls to tell people, hey, I'm a student at this school. I want to do an internship. These are the days I've got. I'd love to come by and do a shadow day with you. And we have a shadow day, which happens early in the fall. A lot of kids get internships through their networks. All the seniors have done it before. The juniors, it's new for them. And then what happens for these 11th and 12th grade teachers on these days, whether it's a Monday or a Friday, depending on the year, is that they have meetings in the morning where they get together and talk about all the things they need to do to keep an eye on where they are in the process of the internships, because they're all moving at the same pace. And then they cut out in the afternoon to go see students at internships and check in with mentors and do all that work. And so basically the 11th and 12th grade classes stop. Those advisors are full-time internship coordinators. And that's what happens for about 10 weeks. And then through those 10 weeks, they focus on different areas of whether or not, whether students are working on getting their projects completed, or at the very beginning, of course, there's still a few students that are struggling to get internships. All throughout, students are writing blogs so that we can see kind of where they are, and they're documenting what they're doing and what they're learning about. And that whole process, after about 10 weeks, ends up at the end of the calendar year. And then in January or so, we'll do exhibitions. And so students will have a chance to do presentations, again, kind of like the defenses, but these are just about their internships, to tell folks about what it was they did. And that's when we have a whole bunch of students from the whole school come and watch and learn more about all the different opportunities they had while they were working and learning outside of school, so that our 9th and 10th graders and will have the opportunity to have some exposure to the program before they get there, and so they know how to go about it when they do. And so that's generally how the program works.
So there's very few people that I've ever met that would say that internships are just not good for students. I think some of the pushback is, you know, are they worth the sacrifice in time that you have to make? And would these 10 weeks of your 5 classes, 6 classes a day and an extra time on content specific to state standards, you know, would that help the students more than these sort of more ambiguous, squishier, soft skill exploration things in the community with mentors who aren't trained educators, who are of varying quality, not a whole lot of quality control around the mentor. Why is that better? And is it really worth sacrificing the time? And, you know, I'm teeing this one up for you because I know what kind of work you've done, but what would you say is the value of internships and why you think this is an important structure to have in your school?
I think that for some students, the experience is transformational. If they're ready and you know, you get what you give in a lot of ways, and if you're ready and accept the invitation to really push yourself and experience things that you certainly wouldn't have if you were in school, then it's a really transformational experience. There are plenty of students, and this is one of the areas that I really want to focus on at our school, is that they, for any number of reasons, don't really seek out or find a good internship or a mentor that's going to be a real support for them. And they end up interning, say, in like an elementary school that they attended. And so they're kind of in a safe zone. They're not exposed to any new careers, any new ideas about where they might be in the world. And so those might not be as transformational. But at the same time, even if a student is not seeing something new, they're in the same school they were at before, they're still seeing themselves at a different stage in their career. To see themselves as a mentor to younger students or as in a different position in terms of their maturity, like that reflection potentially has a lot of power as well. And so the first thing I would say is that there's a difference between saying they're going to be useful or meaningful and recognizing that learning happens at different stages and different points for different people. And one of the most important things schools can do is to make sure that opportunities are open for students to invite those in whenever they're possible. And so my answer to someone who says like it might be more useful for certain students to spend more time working on Common Core standards and getting ready for placement exams so they can take college-ready courses when they get to college, yeah, that might be true for some students. But at the same time, I think that we can't insist that a diversity of experience and a diversity of opportunities to learn new ways of thinking and put ourselves in new positions and for students to see themselves in new ways is not as important as doing the rest of the work that we do. I think that there's a balance. And it's hard to make a compelling case because it's so individual, right? I mean, the experience that any one student has in this internship is unique from every other student. And that's a really, I think, threatening thing for a lot of people, is to say, I don't have control over that. And so for a lot of teachers, they'll say, yeah, I'd rather have them all in my class because I know what I can teach them. I have a plan. I've got a design backwards based on where I want the outcomes to be. And when we send kids out into the world to work with adults, we don't have control over that. And so it's a challenging thing for a lot of teachers. A lot of the pushback that you just gave as examples, we certainly get and we talk about. But for me, my position and my experience have taught me that for students to have those kinds of opportunities is invaluable. And sometimes they're going to learn something that you never thought that they needed to learn. But there's an important experience that came from that, so long as you spend the time doing the reflection and really having a chance to process what happened, right? I think that for me is the part where if there is any kind of quote unquote control, it's in making sure that you make space for the students to reflect on what were the experiences they had, what were the decisions they made, what were the implications of those decisions, to help them understand going forward how they're going to do that when they're looking for internships in college or when they're looking for jobs. So I don't know if I completely answered your question, but it's a complex thing, and it's close to my heart and to yours as well. So I'm open to follow-ups if it's helpful.
And wouldn't you also say that there's an equity issue? I think children with privileged families definitely understand the value of internships and will make sure that those happen every summer after school and help, you know, build their resume, their life experiences, their opportunities to explore their interests. And the families with kids whose parents have fewer connections don't don't get that without a school stepping in to say, you know what, it's important and we're going to help you get it.
Absolutely. And I think the outcome of students actually being given the opportunity to step out and do this means that they're going to start building up these networks and connections that they might not have had, right? So many students come back and get paying jobs or letters of recommendation or jobs when they're in college based on the connections they made while they were doing these internships. And so that's part of us really meeting the other side of that equity issue of really helping students build up those networks that other students have as a privilege of their families' already existing networks.
We don't have so much time, but I wanted to focus a little bit on what else is happening in your classrooms at Impact Academy that is student-centered. Are there other highlights from your curriculum or from courses offered that can show us some of the possibilities?
I think that some of the things I'm most excited about right now are Denise Huey is our ninth grade algebra teacher, and she's in the second year of teaching a computer science and coding elective that's in the morning. And so we'll have at 7:30 in the morning, students will come out early 2 days a week, over 40 of them to come out and learn how to code. We get some resources from Facebook, which has been really generous in supporting that, as well as virtual reality goggles and tools. We've got some drones flying around the hallways in the mornings, which are exciting. And just students really have an opportunity to explore an area that they have not been able to before. We're right on the edge of Silicon Valley, which of course is a really important economic zone for us, but also students of color that attend our school typically don't have a lot of access to careers in that field. And so it's exciting to see what we can do to bridge that gap to a place that's so close by. So that's one thing that I'm so excited to see students in there, and they got to take a trip to Google and a trip to Facebook. And so it's, again, it's getting students outside the school and seeing opportunities that they might otherwise had the opportunity to see. We have the partnership I mentioned with the Network for Teaching Entrepreneurship, where students had a chance to go to different sites and meet with business leaders and actually present and get some feedback on their business plans as they work in teams and learn how to make pitches about problem solving as entrepreneurs. And so that's gotten students outside the school, which has been really exciting, and to compete with other students as well, which is fun for students, but also gives them a chance to see what they need to do to lift up their game and to collaborate well and form teams well together. I've got a teacher named Vlad Sorato who has invented two new electives as part of his case or part of his course load. And one of them is sociolinguistics, which is an area he has background in. And the other one is in digital storytelling or podcasting. And both of those courses are really good examples of where I want the school to push in terms of giving students an opportunity to really determine what is the line of inquiry they want to pursue. So in most courses, a teacher has a lesson plans and we've got the curriculum around what are the things that we're going to cover and what are the projects and ways we're going to engage in that. And students often have a lot of choice, which is important. And his course, students have much more choice about what areas they're going to pick and choose and what they're going to research, what they're going to study and what they want to learn. And so that's an area that I'm really excited about. And the internship program that I were just talking about is probably the best example of that, where every student has to figure out where do I want to intern? Like, what do I want to do? What kind of people do I want to work with? And that's entirely up to the student. We coax and support and cajole as much as we can, but that's not a case where a teacher comes in with a lesson plan and a curriculum and says, here's where you're going to be going, what you're going to be doing. We just say, hey, write a resume, make some phone calls, and let's figure out what you care about. And so for me, that's really where the edge that I want us to be focusing on is how do students take more ownership? How do they guide their learning more? And how do they become much more in control of where they're going as students and learning how to learn because we're not going to be with them after this next couple of years. You know, they're going to be off to college and off to careers. And so I want them to be able to figure that out for themselves and navigate on their own and making really good use of the resources at their disposal.
Well, I would be happy to send my children to your school. And I thank you for the great work you're doing with your school and building that culture that you've described. I think there's a lot of teachers listening to this podcast and other educators, maybe some parents. Where should they go if they want to learn more about Impact Academy?
Yeah, we've got, I would say, take a look at, there's a bunch of, I'd say, videos and other resources either on Envision Education on the website for our whole network. We have schools in Oakland and one school in San Francisco, and then my school down in Hayward, all in the Bay Area, the San Francisco Bay Area. And then you can look up Impact Academy of Arts and Technology and see what's on there. There's some great stuff, including some videos from Edutopia and a case study from Stanford and some other information. And people can feel free to email me too if you want me to. I can give you my email now, or you can put it up on the podcast.
Yeah, I'll put it on the podcast, and that website is www.envisionschools.org, ENVISIONSCHOOLS.org, Envision Schools. And there you could find the link to Impact Academy. And Sean, you're doing great work. Thanks again for being on the Student Centered Learning podcast. And any final word of wisdom for anyone out there?
The final word of wisdom. At the risk of being too simple, I think just listen very closely to what students are saying. And that's, they often understand what's going on. And if we slow down enough for just a moment and hear what students are saying, that's a really important way to guide the work that we do with young people.
That's a good one. I appreciate that. Thank you, Sean.
I appreciate you. Thank you, Arthur.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Student-Centered Learning Podcast. We'll be back next week with another interview. And remember, learning happens best when students are at the center.